Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this informational hearing of the Health Finance and Policy Committee and the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee. We're having a joint informational hearing this morning to talk about the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. And what a bill it is. I am looking at the document that we got, the so-called short summary document from House Research. And I note that the short summary is 16 pages. So we have a lot to cover here. And this is the product of an enormous amount of work by a lot of people. So we're very proud to bring this to you today. And we're going to proceed here by, this is an informational hearing, so we won't be taking any votes or taking any official action, but we're holding this hearing so that we can give the public some information so that members can get some information. We realize that there is a lot here, and most members have not been able to see the bill up before very recently when we posted the delete everything amendment and the spreadsheet. And there is a lot to cover. So we obviously won't be able to cover all of it, but we hope to just zip through some very quickly. We're going to ask staff to walk through the spreadsheet quickly, and then hopefully we'll have some time for questions at the end. We do have a floor session coming up at 10 o'clock, so we are a little bit constrained in our time. So I would just like to start out just by telling you that, as I said, a lot of people worked on this bill. After the official conference committee was concluded at the end of the regular session, and you all know that we were successful in passing a conference report, which was quite large. And that passed and was enacted, that contained some items that were not controversial, that we were able to move that out quickly. We then became a working group, which was just an informal group. But we had five members of this body who were actively engaged in negotiating the bill. And our process, however, was that we work closely with the administration, with our two commissioners who are here with us today, who are going to say a few words as well. And we all, but I want to make it very clear that we work together as a team. This was not something where individual members just made decisions by themselves with the Senate. We worked very closely as a team. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Representative Schultz, if you want to say a few words and get us going here. And go ahead, please.
Well, thank you, Chair Liebling. I just want to thank Chair Liebling for running an exceptional conference committee and working group, and all the members that contributed, conferees and working group members, and particularly our staff, nonpartisan and partisan and fiscal staff and agency staff, and putting together this really historic Health and Human Services bill. I'm really proud of the work we accomplished. We spent a lot of time and energy on this. I'm eager to get this out in the public and to get it in front of our members so they can see how wonderful it actually is. There's great reforms in here. On my side, Human Services, we were fortunate to have a significant amount of federal funding for home and community-based services. And so we put over $250 million into PCAs for a greater than 10% rate increase. We invested in rates for home health and increased the elderly waiver rates. We did some grants for customized living. We put money for Waiver Reimagine. And we invested in age-friendly communities across the state. And we really focused on keeping people with disabilities and older adults as independent as possible, providing services and support so they could live independently and thrive. There's behavioral health reforms and investments. There's investments in substance use disorder reforms to improve outcomes and quality of treatment. There's housing support rate increases and many, many things in the bill that I don't want to list. We'll go through, but I'll turn it over to the rest of the team, I think Representative Pinto and then Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Chair Schultz, and thank you, Chair Liebling. As members know, I'm the chair of the Early Childhood Committee, and it's a little bit unusual because the provisions from that committee didn't pass through these two committees. They were merged in Ways and Means. But we, as Chair Liebling said, we worked very much as a team in pulling this together. It's also unusual because, and similar to what Chair Schultz just referenced, the child care portions of the bill really were funded through significant federal funds. In fact, pretty much exclusively, I think that on balance, we actually were a net contributor to the general fund spending and the rest of the bill out of the early childhood area, really pretty much 100% coming out of dedicated federal funds. We'll be having a review of a lot of that in the Early Childhood Committee tomorrow, but I know that as staff goes through the spreadsheet later, I'm sure they'll walk through some of that. But I just want to note how, despite what I've said, how integrated a focus there is in the bill on the well-being of young kids, of pregnant women, the period after birth, and of there's so much in the bill, as we're going to see when we go through the spreadsheet, to make sure that those earliest days of weeks and months and years go really, really well. And when we do that, we have such big payoffs for the rest of Minnesota. And there's so much that's integrated very well throughout the different areas of this bill in that way, and I'm really proud of that. So many thanks to the chairs for their work, chance to work with the commissioners, and we'll go from there. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. And then we have Chair Gomez with us today. And I don't know if also Peter, Chair Peter Fisher, too, but Chair Gomez, turn it over to you.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. And, you know, again, just to all, to the staff and the folks supporting this work. I'm not on either of the big committees. I'm the chair of the Preventing Homelessness Division. And so it's been just really, you know, I've learned a lot. And the thing that just strikes me is, like, you know, because that we have sort of all of the members of the Health and Human Services Committees here is, you know, the complication and importance of this work in the lives of people in our state. It just has really struck me and stayed with me. And so I'm really thankful to all of the members on this call for your commitment to this work, because it's not easy, and having to make, you know, sort of decisions between different good things is really a hard thing to do. So I just briefly, a couple of things that I wanted to highlight that are in the bill. One is about the really historic investment that we've made in homelessness in this bill, and you know, that Chair Schultz put forward in our original House position and that we were able to carry through. We, you know, the pandemic, of course, has just kind of tested the system in homelessness and has revealed what it means to have not invested in the way that we need to. But our homelessness provider and advocacy community, the way that they've stepped up in the last 15 months, you know, I mean, it's kind of a miracle that we didn't have. Or it's not a miracle, it's like the result of diligent work on the part of providers, that there wasn't a bigger impact in this community on COVID. So we do you know, add ESP, which is a flexible funding source for homelessness service providers, to the base, and some emergency shelter money. We also do Representative Fisher has, we do kind of some smaller policy things, some reports and allowing homeless youth to have access to identification, which is sometimes gets difficult for them. The other piece is that we did a couple important things for families who are enrolled in MFIP, in the Minnesota Family Investment Program. We have the first ever cost of living adjustment for those families. For 30,000 families in Minnesota who are living in deep poverty. And, you know, this program is funded by the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, the block grants that we get from the feds that replaced welfare in the 90s. And, you know, I think about, like, what's happened to the cost of living since the 90s. And other kind of entitlement programs, you know, Social Security has had an automatic cost of living adjustment linked to, you know, the consumer price index since the 70s. And we've never provided families who are trying to get back on their feet on MFIB with that just like basic acknowledgement that, you know, it's more expensive now to support a family than it was then. So we do a one-time cash payment for those families and a cost of living adjustment. And again, Chair Pinto said, just a lot of good things for families and kids who are struggling. So thank you so much, and looking forward to walking through the spreadsheet.
All right. Thank you so much, Chair Gomez. And I just want to also acknowledge that Chair Fisher is also here, and that he is the chair of the Behavioral Health Division, and worked hard on the substance use disorder and mental health provisions that are in the bill, of which there are many. So this bill covers a lot of ground. So, and for my area, for the health area, I just would emphasize what Chair Pinto said. There is a lot in this bill that helps moms and babies and families. And we can all be extremely proud of that. It was really, that piece of it was really a shared priority with the Senate, I'm happy to say. And so we have in here things like the Dignity in Pregnancy and Childbirth Act. We have increased funding for lead risk assessments and increasing, we're going to be doing better on that score, protecting young children. We have some increased funding for home visiting. We've expanded postpartum care under medical assistance to 12 months from 60 days. And that just scratches the surface. So many other great things in the bill. But because we're so short on time, I'm going to turn it over now to Commissioner Harpstead from Department of Human Services. Let her say a few words, and then we'll ask Commissioner Malcolm to say a few words as well. Commissioner Harpstead.
Thank you, Chairs and members of the House Health and Human Services Committees. Thank you for your time this morning. This budget, which started back in the fall with budget cut scenarios before the November forecast, remember that, and ends with a meaningful investment in health and human services, is truly one that serves our DHS mission. The Minnesota Department of Human Services, working with many others, helps people meet their basic needs so they can live in dignity and achieve their highest potential. It has something in it for Minnesotans of all walks of life. We're very proud at DHS to have centered children and families in our budget work this year. We uncovered data last fall as we were first developing proposals that taught us that Minnesota has been named as the best state in the nation by the AARP for older adult services. And we spend more per person on people with disabilities than almost any other state. Yet our CCAP childcare rates put us on the border of federal noncompliance, and it took over 30 years to increase our MFIP payments once. This bill includes the maternal and infant health provisions you've heard about, the COLA and one-time cash payments for families on MFIP to help them climb out of COVID and out of deep poverty, and an increase to CCAP childcare rates that puts us out of federal non-compliance territory. We appreciate how these provisions will support the Wells Flanagan vision of Minnesota being the best place for children to grow up, all children. This bill also includes a healthy package of services for people experiencing homelessness, a variety of provisions to allow older adults and people with disabilities to live independently as long as they would like, such as the Age-Friendly Minnesota Commission, an increase in elderly waiver services, support of the PCA industry and other home care and home health agencies, an earlier inflation adjustment for the DWRS providers for people with disabilities, phase two of Waiver Reimagine, behavioral health investments, case management redesign, substance use disorder service reform, and mental health uniform services and standards. Healthcare investments, a major investment in telehealth, incorporating all we've learned through COVID. 90-day prescriptions, as we also piloted through COVID. Improvements to the child and teen checkup program, and ensuring access to public transportation for people on medical assistance. It also included vital operational investments for our agencies, operating adjustments for DHS, MDH, and DCT, direct care and treatment, that is, a list of items that keep us in compliance with federal regulation, resources and policy changes to ensure our background studies division has the infrastructure needed to meet the needs of providers, investments to help us get back to better as we stand back up programs coming out of COVID, and payment of the tribal MAT and county IMD overpayments from 2019 to put those issues to rest once and for all. The HHS bill does a particularly good job of centering racial equity with investments in safer maternal and infant health, healthcare coverage for moms and their babies for a year postpartum, investment in the implementation of the Families First Preservation Services Act, and the Iqua County Training Academy. Nearly all of the ideas coming out of our tribal consultation were included. We're grateful for the federal funds that contribute to so many Minnesotans and Minnesota organizations coming out of COVID and out of economic hardship. And I would like to thank all of our HHS committee chairs who slogged through a boatload of federal funds with us and came out understanding more about the inner workings of DHS than perhaps they ever wanted to. But we will all be stronger partners for having plowed through this exercise together. Thank you to all the staff who checked their cell phones every few minutes to see if they would be called back into negotiations day and night for the last 6 weeks. We're very eager to put COVID, payment errors, shutdown planning, and this budget session behind us to roll out this extraordinary investment in the lives of the people that we support. Thank you for all of you for who you are for the people of Minnesota.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Malcolm, welcome.
Good morning, Chair Liebling and members of the joint committees. Let me just echo my extraordinary colleague, Commissioner Harpstead's thanks to all of you, to the members, the chairs, the members, and the staff, as well as our agency staff who have worked so diligently. As you have said many a time, Madam Chair, this bill is mind-boggling in the scope and the complexity of the issues that you've dealt with. And I think just my deep personal thanks for extraordinary leadership in getting us through this bill. From a public health perspective, I would just echo a couple of the things Commissioner Harpstead and Chair Liebling mentioned. The importance of things that aren't very sexy but are very critical, operating funds for not only for our general operating purposes for our agencies, but making sure that programs that are reliant on fee revenue, for example, can really keep pace with the expectations of Minnesotans. At a higher level, certainly this last year and a half, it feels like 10, have been extraordinary for public health in terms of the COVID pandemic. And what I really want to call out about this bill at the beginning here is the way that this bill and the House in particular have really recognized the importance of the public health infrastructure. And there are funds in this bill that provide badly needed increases in the core kind of general operating support for local public health, the first significant increase in the local public health grant in many, many years. And in addition, some funds that will allow us to really harvest the lessons of COVID and continue and accelerate the work that's been going on for a couple of years now to think about how we improve the entire public health system as a whole, not just its parts, not just the state health department or tribal health departments or local health departments, but how do we make a more seamless and overall effective public health system? So I'm very, very grateful and excited about the funds that will allow us to pilot some new approaches of collaboration between state, local, and tribal health, and to really increase the capacity everywhere in the state to really meet those foundational public health requirements that really it's increasing clarity from a national perspective about what the standards for core public health services really need to be. This has the potential to truly transform the relationships between the various pieces of the public health system and to further solidify our position as national public health leaders. With a particular focus, I must say, on health equity through these redesign efforts, making sure that public health is serving as best we can those folks who have historically been underserved, and that equity will be at the center of these redesign efforts. The chair and Commissioner Harpstead have both mentioned the rather extraordinary package of initiatives to improve the health of mothers and infants. And from a public health perspective, there's not much you can do that is more upstream and more full of impact for lifelong health than to improve the health of mothers and infants. And again, with a very, very strong equity focus. In addition to the postpartum Medicaid coverage that's been mentioned, and the Dignity in Pregnancy Act, which is so wonderful, a few elements of that Dignity in Pregnancy and Childbirth Act are squarely aimed at confronting the realities of racism and implicit bias in the way that that pregnant women and new moms and babies are served. So there are investments here in training, continuing education requirements for providers, and support to increase their awareness and their competency in those areas, as well as initiatives to figure out how we can strengthen midwife and doula services, and many more provisions as well. Some things to strengthen the newborn screening program, including something called the Vivian Act, which was, I think, as Chair Liebling said, a shared priority that emanated in the Senate. We were happy to see that included. Also, as Chair Liebling mentioned, some really, really important improvements in reducing environmental health risks. Madam Chair mentioned the lowering of the level of lead in blood tests that will trigger risk assessments and strengthen our ability to order mitigation. That is a really big deal from a child health standpoint. Again, with a strong equity focus, given the disproportionate exposure to high lead levels in homes, schools, and workplaces for our BIPOC communities. And finally, we in public health mostly are focused on, certainly on the control of infectious diseases, but in addition, doing everything we can to go as far upstream as we can to prevent the major causes of chronic illness and premature death among our population. And even though we've been working on anti-tobacco, commercial tobacco prevention campaigns and cessation campaigns with a fair degree of success over many decades, the gains that we've seen in reducing youth smoking or use of commercial regular tobacco products has completely been overshadowed in the last couple of years by the rise of vaping among our kids. So very grateful to the House in particular for making sure that we are beginning to build back a strong and robust tobacco and vaping prevention effort in our state as Clearway, Minnesota sunsets at the end of this year. So many other provisions spanning the work of the health department, but I just wanted to call out a few of those broader themes. Thank you again, everyone, for this incredible work. I join you in our enthusiasm for this and eagerness to get at the business of implementing it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner Malcolm. And just want to say that it's been a great pleasure working with both of you and your staffs. You have all been really extraordinary partners in this work. And it's just been, I've said this before, I know many times, but I don't think Minnesotans really understand what incredible people they have working for them. And, from top to bottom in our agencies, it is, not to mention in the House here, our staff as well, but just because we're speaking with the commissioners, we really do need to call out the agency staff who are just amazing public servants. So thank you very much. Okay, Mr. Burke, we are going to ask Mr. Burke to walk through our spreadsheet, which is frankly enormous. And a lot of course, what is on the spreadsheet, just as background, when we were actually doing the negotiating, we were working off something we were calling the shopping list, which was a condensed version of the spreadsheet with only one or two lines for each item to help us be able to get through and understand what we were doing. And what we're looking at here is the complete spreadsheet with all of the tracking. Even the shopping list was, I think, about 8 pages long with tiny little lines, as you all know. I almost sometimes feel like you need a magnifying glass to read it. And so this one's long and complicated, but Mr. Berg, I'm sure, will walk us through it and pretty quickly, but you all do have this available to you as well, and it is posted for the public. So, Mr. Berg, welcome.
Madam Chair and members, this is the detail sheet. I'll try to go through it as rapidly as possible to kind of give the flavor. As the chair mentioned, this should be posted, I believe. It's on the fiscal staff website, and I believe also on the committee page. Starting just with the summary at the top, if you look at line 6, which is the general fund total, the line above that is the all direct appropriations total, all funds direct. But the general fund total, you'll note that in years 21 through 23, there is a net expenditure above base in the general fund of $100 million, and there is a net expenditure in the general fund above base of $100 million in the tails, which was the direction this committee or this bill was given. I will say that because of the complexity of the federal money, there's a lot of detail below that $100 million. There is, and we will come to an offset item to the costs in the general fund of $686.1 million of federal money, which is based on enhanced federal medical assistance participation for home and community-based services. This sheet treats all that money. We're putting that money into the general fund as a savings to the general fund, and then this sheet treats all the appropriations the same. It doesn't matter whether it's federal HCBS or general fund, it's all general fund. So the $100 million above base subsumes a savings of $686 million. Couple other notes I'll point out. The Healthcare Access Fund came in with a balance of zero in fiscal 25 in the February forecast. This bill leaves a total of $94.7 million on the bottom line of the Healthcare Access Fund in 25. However, $61 million of that is reserved for a dental initiative. So the true balance in 25 in the Healthcare Access Fund is $32 million, where it was zero in February, and the TANF balance is $47.2 million at the end of the four-year period. And there are quite a few other federal allocations in here as well, but I'll mention those as we come to them.
Mr. Berg, if I could just interrupt you for 1 second, I just want to make sure that members understand, and maybe for the public, when we talk about this federal money, this home and community-based services, HCBS, the acronym that members of these committees know, that is the way we've been talking about it, the shorthand. And even though in the spreadsheet before you, it will all look like general fund money, I just want people to be very clear that this money came with restrictions on how it could be used. And when we looked at it on the so-called shopping list, we were treating it separately because it can only be spent on certain things that meet the federal requirements. And so I just want to make that clear. As you look at this spreadsheet, you're kind of seeing the final, and you may not be seeing which things we could allocate federal money to. But I just want to make sure that you understand that that those strings were attached, are attached, and that we spent a significant amount of time figuring out how we could use that money and make it work in the spreadsheet. So I hope that is helpful. Go ahead, Mr. Berg.
That's correct. And Madam Chair, members can look up for another view at what those items are. The article following the finance article in the DE amendment, which I believe is Article 17, has language which outline it's essentially like what rider language would normally look like, but because of the way this came together, we put it all in an article after the finance article, so you can look at that and see descriptions of the projects. All right, moving on quickly, I will run through which items are included. I unless there are questions, I guess I won't mention the specific amounts here. We included the governor's recommendation on the nursing facility reassessment item, the modified version of the nursing facility moratorium exception project item that was the Senate brought that in. The simple explanation on child care is that it is the 40th percentile for infants and toddlers and 30th percentile for others. It also includes the 3-year reprioritization of the wait list and $15 million a year for 3 years of additional basic sliding fee. The House is House File 388, the Cultural and Ethnic Leadership Council is included. This is a portion, there are the childcare things are in a variety of places. I'll note them as we come through. And I should note, you'll see that these are dedicated. These are all of the childcare appropriations are from federal funds, with the slight exception of, I believe it's $18,000 of general fund money to for systems costs and the rate. All the rest of the childcare items are from federal funds. In this case, there are, this is some of the CCDBG money, which is goes for the Family Child Care One-Stop Assistance Network, the website modifications, routine grants, the early ed governance report, the Family Child Care Coordination Report, IT and systems improvements for child care, and a early ed working group and child care workforce development grants. There is also additional child care workforce development grants from the stabilization fund. Again, that is federal money, not state money. There's a federally funded child care licensing licensing models project from the stabilization fund. Child care business training program grants from the stabilization fund, again, federal funds. Child care facility revitalization grants from both federal sources, stabilization and CCDBG. I'll pause just a minute. The stabilization fund, which is $324 million of federal funds, federal law requires 90% of that to be used for monthly grants to providers, and that is this $304 million right here. Is going to go out over the next 3 years, I believe it is, in monthly grants to providers. They have to apply for them, but federal law requires that use of it. Again, federal funds for the family, friend, and neighbor caregivers item, the family child care shared services pilot project. Now, this is, we're getting, well, it sounds like a child care one, this is out of the child care realm. The Federal Family First Prevention Services Act, there is there was a governor's recommendation, which is in on largely assisting counties and the department in implementing this federal law. The House's House File 944, which relates to residential treatment and children's mental health items. A governor's recommendation on the North Star Care for Children, which is our name for our foster care program, complying with federal requirements. There is a item that both the House and Senate had. Again, this is a child care item on a report on foster care children's engagement in early care and education programs. This is a federally funded item. The governor's recommendation on Indian child welfare training, ICWA training, is included. The governor's recommendation on addressing the SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program error rate, is included. There are a couple of no-cost items where the governor recommended some language that relates to financing, but it has no direct cost. We included the one on allowing tribal governments access to the Minnesota Food Assistance Program and some statute clarification. Also, a change to the community action formula that I believe includes tribes in that. As part of that, we brought in some additional funding of $1 million a year to the Community Action Formula. There is a item the governor recommended on clarifying the language around public assistance statutes, which does not have a cost, but is included. Again, going back to federal funding for child care, this is federal money for the Child Care Center Regulation Modernization Project. And then following it is a related item on the Family Child Care Regulation Modernization Project, again, federally funded. You'll note on line 281, this also includes funding for the Family Child Care Advisory Committee. Again, that's all out of federal funds. We included the governor's recommendation on child care assistance program retroactive payments, which is a savings. It changes the way the state deals with retroactive payments. Again, going back to federal money, this is payment for background study fees for child care providers. This is essentially covering the background checks for many child care providers so that as we come out of COVID, and there are also quite a few background check changes in this bill later, this makes it so the child care providers are not going to have to essentially pay a second time for background checks, and that's all federal money. We have administrative funding for the CCDBG allocations. Again, that's federal money to administer federal program, federal money. There is family child care provisions. This contains two items. The House and Senate both had bills to create a new ombudsperson for family child care providers, which is included. And then there is a parent-aware evaluation study, a validation study. Those two items, again, are paid strictly from federal funds, no state funds in there. Moving down, this is the it's Senate File 941, but it also, there was a House file from Representative Becker Finn, which isn't listed there, that deals with court-appointed counsel for child protection cases. It includes both administrative changes at the agency and then funding for the counties, grants to the counties to cover some of the cost of counsel. Another federally funded child care item is the TEACH grants are included. Going down to, there are child support policy modifications that, again, there was also a Representative Becker Finn bill that isn't, the number is not listed here, but both sides have this item. Two more no-cost items in the governor's budget has the employment exemption for high school students that be eligible in some cases for UI, which has no cost in this bill, and a provision to align SNAP employment and training statutes with federal requirements, which also has no direct cost. This item Representative Gomez mentioned, which is one-time payments through the MFIP program. The estimated payment here is $435 per family unit, or assistance unit rather is the term. I will note this is federal pandemic emergency funds here. We're not spending state funds. The House originally had used TANF funds for this, but we have this pool of $14.4 million in federal pandemic emergency funds, which is being used for this purpose. The MFIP cost of living adjustment that was mentioned, this is split between TANF funds, federal TANF funds, and the state general fund. That was done to bring the general fund impact down. And as I mentioned, there's still also a TANF balance available, so that can continue into the future. House File 294 was Representative Noor's re-upping the homeless youth report is included. The maintaining family connections in foster care background study modification, which the governor, the House, and the Senate all had positions on. And there is a much modified provision in here that is between all of those. The behavioral health grant reductions, this is an item where there is a reduction in the state grant, which is being backfilled with federal money on a mental health grant. The case management redesign of initial case management redesign initial reform, which was a governor's recommendation, is included. The MA rate for adult foster care providers, crisis stabilization services item is included. Home health services rate modifications, and while you can't tell the difference, there's a series of sort of new items here that came in with the federal funds. This is one. You can't tell the difference here, but if you look at Article 17, you will see the what looks like rider language for many of these. There is a rate increase for home care providers. The governor's recommendation for mental health uniform service standards that came out of Representative Fisher's committee is included. The intensive rehabilitative mental health services modifications is included. Another part of House File 970 is the culturally informed and culturally responsive mental health task force, which is included. There is substance use disorder provider a reduction in regulatory acts. This was popularly referred to as the paperwork reduction bill. There is an item for customized living quality improvement grants that adds money to that that program. There is a modification housing support rates. There is, this is another area where we're allocating federal funds. This is the SAMHSA administration, which is the Substance Abuse and Mental Health, I forget what the second house is, administration. This is the federal mental health block grant, which is allocated here to stakeholder grant proposals. This is kind of a bucket for stakeholder ideas. There are other allocations that will come to. The next one is administration of the federal mental health block grant. There is additional funding for school link mental health grants from the federal mental health block grant. The House File 1600, which is an adult mental health initiative grants, is included. There is a new item created, a new program created with the federal substance abuse block grant, which is the school-linked substance abuse program, which is meant to be kind of mirror the school-linked mental health grants, but focus on school-age people with substance abuse issues. There is a Senate item, the Pathfinder Companion Pilot Project. This is again funded with federal substance abuse grant, block grant money. The Opioid Epidemic Response Grants is from the federal substance abuse block grant. This is a large stakeholder pool for various projects. Again, this is the substance abuse block grant portion of that. Previously seen the mental health block grant portion. Here's the administrative funding for this administering the federal substance abuse block grant. The House's provision for recovery community organization grants is included. The governor's recommendation on waiver reimagined. This is sort of updating and changing the way our MA waivers will work in the future. That's included. Plus, there was an additional item that was created during the negotiations that puts in residential criteria and stakeholder informed choice and has small costs at the beginning, but creates savings in the tails. Moving on, we have the governor's recommendation for disability program modifications. That's a portion of the governor's recommendation, but not all of the reductions were taken. The governor's recommendation for the EIDBI background study, that's EIDBI is the autism benefit in autism services benefit in medical assistance. There's another cost neutral item here that allows tribal access to the Minnesota Housing Support Program. Homelessness, Representative Gomez mentioned, this is a there's a lot of revision to the governor's original position. Within the numbers you see, there is $12 million in the 22-23 biennium and ongoing for emergency services grants, $2 million each biennium for emergency shelter grants, and then you'll see that of the governor's original position, there is $5 million for 3 years of the community living infrastructure grants portion of the governor's program. In some cases, you'll see the reason there's a three-year, this tells you that we used federal money in the offer for it because it only runs through 2024 and the federal HCBS money needs to be expended by March of 2024. And then there's the admin cost for that. So the PCA service rate increase, this is the PCA contract is included. Then in addition, the House came in with a PCA rate framework to boost PCA rates an additional amount, and that is here. There is a provision for, it's referred to as PCA drivers allowed to drive recipients to appointments, but it's really the PCA program is changing into community first services and supports. I believe later this summer is when that becomes active. And so it's CFSS providers will get paid for the time they spend driving their clients to and from appointments and things like that. The Senate brought in an item to in advance the date of the next DWRS inflation adjustment. So the rate adjustment, inflation adjustment for DWRS providers is moved up by 6 months here. And then the House delayed the one after that. Well, it's like all parties at this point agreed to delay the next DWRS inflation adjustment by 4 months. So the next one is advanced by 6 months, and the one after that is delayed by 4 months. And the net for the providers is an improvement on their rate all across the board on this. There is the item for enhanced rates for PCA recipients who get 10 or more hours a day of services. This includes the temporary rates for parent and spouse providing those services, and it expands the categories of service providers who qualify from this from just the PCA to a slightly broader group who provide these same services. There is an item to develop a new service in the PCA program for acute care hospitals. There is administrative funding to administer the $686 million of FMAP money. House File 287, the Sober Housing Oversight Study is included. There is most of the governor's disability grant reduction item here is gone. This shows that the moving of grants from the state quality council to the regional quality councils is included. It doesn't change the funding, it just changes at what level the money is allocated. The statewide parent-to-parent program for families with a child with a disability program is included. The parent House File 390, the Parent Support for Better Outcomes bill is included. The Senate File 296, the Parenting with a Disability Pilot Project, is included. It includes both the House had proposed a study of this purpose, and the Senate actually implements the study for 1 year so we can evaluate how it works. Senate File 858, self-advocacy grants for people with developmental disabilities. This is an expansion of a self-advocacy program that has been funded for many years. The grants for childcare providers to serve children with disabilities is included. This is a general fund item because this didn't quite, this is, it's more like a disability grant item than a child care grant item. So we couldn't use the federal fund, child care funds for this purpose, but it did go to the general fund. The Senate's provision for the Minnesota Inclusion Initiative, Senate File 188, is included. The Senate proposed an item on limiting customized living units within rate formula based on acuity. That's a very cumbersome name, was referred to as the customized living unit rate floor. There is another part of House File 722, the culturally and linguistically appropriate services grant. This has to do with mental health and behavioral health services. We have increased the developmental disability, the first rate increase they have had in many years. The elderly waiver program has got an increase, a rate increase. I'm sorry, this is the customized living rate floor. The other one was a different customized living. This is the customized living rate floor for disproportionate share facilities, those that have a certain percentage of their residents being in the customized living program. The substance use disorder rate add-on for culturally appropriate services, again, for mental health and behavioral health services. The governor's substance use disorder provider payment modification item, which has been fairly heavily worked over during the, it is the same basic idea, but there's been a lot of adjustments to the rates and how the adjustments are made. An item that was included that the House brought in is a repayment of the counties and the tribes on the medication assisted treatment overpayments and the county IMD overpayments. This is where both the counties and the tribes were receiving too high a payment level from DHS, and this money then was owed back by those. This pays the debt so that the counties and tribes no longer have to pay it. The direct care and treatment operating adjustment is included at a slightly modified number, slightly lower number. The governor's recommendation for the CABS program for there to be a county share for the cost of care when individuals don't meet criteria to be in the program. This is effectively when individuals are no longer judged to need to be in the CABS program. This is adolescent behavioral health. At that point, the counties have to pay for the cost if they don't move them out of that facility or out of that program right away. So the Senate brought in a safety net services report as part of the federal money. The governor's item for newborn screening disorders, which is mainly an MDH item, but it has a small general fund cost at DHS. There is also a small DHS impact for the Vivian Act that the Commissioner of Health mentioned. We'll come to the rest of that with the health department. The House File 894, the MA coverage for weight loss drugs is included. The governor's no-cost items for aligning asset limits for Medicare savings plans with the MA low-income subsidy and aligning Minnesota care statutes with federal requirements are both included. This item, This item transfers $54.8 million into the Healthcare Access Fund, and then there was another portion of this dental proposal that was already in the Healthcare Access Fund. It puts it in there, and then there is language in the bill, an uncoded section, which exempts $61,055,000 of the balance in the Healthcare Access Fund from coming into being subject to the transfer requirements into the general fund in Chapter 16. That $61 million is being reserved for a future dental initiative. The negotiations got close to a dental initiative, but not quite to one that worked. So the money that it costs is reserved in the Healthcare Access Fund for future use for that purpose. There is, however, an item where there's really three items within this. There are two studies that relate to dental, and there is some managed care data reporting that relates to dental and other parts of managed care. There is Representative Bierman's bill to add back MA coverage for adult periodontal disease non-surgical treatment. We are eliminating the Minnesota Care family glitch in the Minnesota Care program. That is included. This item puts money, there are requirements in the federal COVID requirements that were passed that the state will get additional BHP revenue if we conform co-pays in the Minnesota Care program to the federal BHP laws. We're doing that here. That generates, you'll see, about $120 million in savings to the state in the Healthcare Access Fund by virtue of the fact that we get more basic health plan revenue, which pays for Minnesota Care first. There is an item to allow 90-day prescription refills and includes a change in the dispensing fee to $10.77. This was a governor's initiative, although it's been modified to include the higher dispensing fee. And House File 1793, the enhanced asthma benefit for children with poorly controlled asthma is included. There is, in this item, there were the House and Senate had different ideas here. The uniform prior authorization the Senate had is not part of this, but the House's Dental Home Advisory Committee and fee disclosure is included here. Both the House and Senate had provisions to extend the MA postpartum benefit eligibility, came in with different amounts. The DE amendment extends it by 12 months. There is a complex item on the expansion of telehealth services. A lot of things under the COVID waivers. There has been a lot of state laws waived to allow telehealth in medicine. This allows some of that to continue, and there is a study to try to further isolate which things work better or should continue in telehealth and which services shouldn't. There is an item to prohibit recoveries of excess payments from durable medical equipment providers that the Senate brought in. The governor's recommendation on redesign of the outreach activities for child and teen checkups is included. The governor's recommendation on continuous access to public transportation through the NEMT program is included. We are canceling an assisted living licensure report card that the Department of Human Services was supposed to do in 2020, but because of the pandemic, they weren't able to do that, so we're canceling that. However, the requirement for that goes on, and so in 22 and 23, the money for the report card is there, and the requirement for them to do that is there. We are taking the governor's item to expand grants for integrated care for high-risk pregnant women. There are no cost items that relate to the time frame for information gathering for inpatient rate setting, a very technical item, has no cost. There's also a rate methodology description in statute for what outpatient services consist of. Again, that's related to finance issues, but has no cost. This governor's recommendation on compliance with interoperability and patient access regulations is included. The governor's recommendation on expanded use of the encounter alerting system is included. Here's another cancellation where there were navigator assistance payments in the related to the MinSure program paid out of the healthcare access fund that didn't get used in 21 because of the pandemic. They're canceled and then reappropriated in the next year. This is called directed payments for non-government owned hospitals. This is House File 1609. It's also just called direct payments, hospital direct payments. There are grants for technology for HCBS recipients. The development of an individual portal for HCBS recipients, so a better essentially web portal and IT connection. Additional funding for housing transitional costs through medical assistance. An item that is transition to community that is helping people move out of facilities into community-based settings. Item on HCBS item on lead agency process mapping, money for age-friendly Minnesota grants to various entities to pursue the age-friendly initiative. Housing stabilization administrative costs are included. There's a small item on continuity of care for students with behavioral health and disability needs, support needs. The provider capacity grants for rural and underserved communities is included. It's an expansion of mobile crisis services grants. The mobile PRTF and child adolescent mobile transition unit. This is relates to children's mental health. An item that seeks to reduce reliance on children's congregate care facilities. There is an item to work on phasing out sub-minimum wage in disabilities programs. This is, for instance, as people think of like sheltered workshops and day services where in some cases people are still being paid sub-minimum wage. This initiative seeks to phase that out, the sub-minimum wage part. There is an item on research to access to long-term care services. Additional funding for respite care grants and a study related to that. There is an outpatient MA outpatient and behavioral health services rates study. I do not remember off the top of my head what MCIL, the acronym there is. This is an HCBS access grant. Again, this is related to the federal funding. There is a joint initiative between the Department of Corrections and DHS related to HCBS or community supports, really, I guess. And there are HCBS workforce development grants, again, related to the federal funding. There is an item related to expanded COVID coverage. There is the maternal and infant health study. This is the DHS part. There are other items at MDH related to maternal health. This is a governor's item on FBI compliance requirements and background checks that is included. There's a small item on preferred drug list modifications and an item that works on reducing co-payments for brand name prescription drugs and medical assistance. There's a governor's item, a recommendation about new background study partners. This is updating backgrounds, how background studies work. There is a background study fee schedule proposal the governor proposed. This is most of it. It accepts the new fees. It doesn't put the fee schedule in statute. And I believe requires the legislature to act if the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension part of the fee is scheduled to go up. There is then a legislative task force on human services background studies. This is the DHS part of it. Will come. There's another part of it. The governor's no cost item on withdrawal management licensing fees is included, as is repeal of the transfer in Chapter 16A from the Healthcare Access Fund to the general fund, which is repealed on July 1st of 2025. The governor's recommendation for reducing fraud, waste, and abuse in public programs is included. And the agency operating adjustment, which is been modified somewhat. There were some additional cost of care recoveries, but it was governor's recommendation. This item just moves money back and forth from the healthcare access fund to the medical via the medical assistance program to balance our budget to the 100 million above general fund base in each biennium. So this is just a technical money item moving money between the two funds. The governor or the Senate rather had an item on self-employment income relative to cash assistance programs that's included. I will note that the Blue Ribbon Commission is no longer relevant to this. There is a transfer from the budget reserve into the general fund of $100 million, and there is language in the finance section that says no other transfer may be made relative to the Blue Ribbon Commission law. So that is taken care of. This item is, as I mentioned before, you'll see that we are taking a savings against the general fund of $686,091,000 in fiscal year 22. Then the save, this represents the amount of the FMAP savings we're getting. And it gets spent over 3 years through March of 24, but we take all the savings here against the general fund. And then there is a governor's recommendation on the COVID-19 waiver transition period. It's also been described as the COVID waiver off-ramp to get things back to the to a normal operating basis. That's the end of the DHS section. The health department quickly, their operating adjustment is included. The Vivian Act that the commissioner mentioned is, most of it is here. There was a small part at DHS, but that's included. This is the rest of the telehealth study I mentioned is included. We'll come to, there is $300,000 going into the public health response account that gets the balance in that up to $5 million for other public health emergencies, hopefully of a more minor nature than the pandemic. The nursing, this is the health department does the work on nursing facility moratorium construction project exceptions. So there was money at DHS to pay the cost of the projects. This is for evaluation and recommendation of the projects. The House's lead risk assessment and order modification item is included. The governor's recommendation on newborn screening disorders fee adjustments included. The governor's recommendation adjusting the asbestos licensing, radioactive materials fees, those are in the SGSR. Medical cannabis items listed here were actually approved in Chapter 30 in regular session. This just shows the impact on the state government special revenue fund, but those are already in law. The governor's recommendation on the health data intermediaries fee adjustment is included. Again, that's SGSR. There's an item the governor recommended to really get rid of excess appropriation authority in the SDSR to make the revenues and the expenditures balance, which it's mostly a paper issue where there's greater spending authority than is actually used. There's an increase to the home visiting grants program for 3 years of $1.5 million a year. The governor's recommendation on the e-health advisory initiative reduction, again, this is a general fund item that's included. We changed on the nurse family partnership and the basic home visiting, that is now in statute. So this is just showing there's a no-cost item allocating the base of that program into a statutory section. Doesn't change the funding for it other than the new money I had mentioned. This is the health department portion of the maternal and infant health study. The CALS program, the Comprehensive Advanced Life Support Program, which was previously funded with one-time money, is now permanently funded. There's a small item for changes to the all-payer claims database. Representative Fisher's bill 162 for homeless youth birth records and ID is included. There is language on hospital sale disclosure, but no cost to that item. There is a cancel and carry forward on an appropriation for non-narcotic pain management where the recipient wasn't able to spend the money in that time period. It's canceled and reappropriated for the same purpose. Part of House File 970, it had two parts at the health department. The first one is 2 years of funding for mental health, cultural, community, continuing education grants. And then the health professional loan forgiveness program is increased along with changes to who's eligible to use it. This uses federal funding, so for at least 3 years, people getting these loan forgiveness programs have to agree to be serving MA patients to receive the loans. You'll see that the money changes from $3 million a year, and then in the third year, it's split between, it says general fund, but again, this is, we use HCBS funds here, so it ends in the third year. The Healthcare Access Fund picks up the difference in that year, and then it moves on to $3.5 million a year from the Healthcare Access Fund from 25 on. The House's bill on the Supporting Healthy Babies grants is included. House File 660, the Dignity in Pregnancy and Childbirth, there are three items funded under this. The development of an anti-racism curriculum that is going to happen at the University of Minnesota, and an item relative to maternal mortality reviews, and then some provisions related to midwifery and doulas. And the local public health area has two pretty substantial items. We've changed this had a different name before, but because what it really does is morphed a little bit, we changed the name to New Local Public Health Funding Distribution Framework. It does two things. It puts $6 million into what's called public health infrastructure funding on a permanent basis. And then it has $1.5 million a year that is an assessment and oversight of the system that is meant to sort of continuously update what the public health infrastructure system looks like and how it ought to change. There's language in the health department section of the bill relative to how that works. And then there's a second item that is an increase in funding for local public health grants. It also has two parts. One is $7 million a year of new funding permanently for the public health formula grants to local public health. And then an addition, $500,000 a year in permanent new funding for tribal public health grants. The tobacco and vaping prevention item has $4 million a year ongoing. The governor's recommendation on the no cost on the vital records electronic transaction fee, also called the convenience fee, that's included. The Senate had a provision that canceled $2.4 million of costs at the health department related to the general fund cost of staff who are currently being paid by federal funds because they're working on COVID things. That's included. There is a change in what is Representative Morris's bill on prescription drug price transparency that the agency recommended. We're canceling $395,000 in 2021 they didn't need and reappropriating $210,000 in 22. That's an agency recommendation to get that one correct. I'll go just in total on the health-related boards. They had a variety of changes in here from the governor that included, in some cases, operating adjustments. There were a couple of minor requests for staffing at a couple of the boards, and there was an administrative move of the administrative services unit from the Board of Executives of Long-Term Support Services to the Board of Dentistries. And then in addition to that, the only changes we made is that five of the boards, there are continuing education requirements related to House File 970 about cultural competency for the five boards where their people are related, the licensees deal with it's, you know, health and social work, behavioral health therapists. The five boards that are most closely aligned with those purposes have some money for the continuing education requirements. And then going down to the other agencies, there's an operating adjustment for the Council on Disability. The Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board, there is $800,000 a year for 2 years for the grants to the regional EMS boards. This does not go to the state board. And the Ombudsman for Mental Health and DD is just an operating adjustment. The Ombudsperson for Families is the operating adjustment. And then there's a creation of a new Ombudsperson for American Indian Families that is funded here. At Minnesota Management and Budget, there are a couple of items. We are refinancing $59,547,000 of excess coronavirus response fund dollars that were not used are being refinanced here. The commissioner of MMB is directed to take those funds and spend them to refinance items in there's a list of prior state acts that where they refinance the general fund expenditure and substitute federal money. So this saves the general fund $59,547,000. I mentioned the Legislative Coordinating Commission. This is the Legislative Task Force on Human Services Background Studies. There is $30,000 to the Supreme Court related to website changes because of the child support changes. And Madam Chair, that goes through the entire spreadsheet.
Well, thank you so much, Mr. Berg. And I think this would be the appropriate moment to really thank Mr. Berg, because I think members can get a kind of a taste here of the enormity of his job and the complexity this year, which is just well beyond the usual complexity of an HHS spreadsheet, which I think most members have a sense of what that is about. And this year, with all of the federal money and the many unusual kind of new unique issues this year, even starting from when we first got our budget, and there were some issues that hadn't been totally figured out about even what our target was. Mr. Berg has been working tirelessly to figure this out and get it into shape and make it work. And we just owe you so much, Mr. Berg. Really, thank you. And please don't go looking for another job, even though we wouldn't blame you if you did, because this one probably sucks up every waking moment that you have sometimes. So with that, I think we could move to member questions. It is 9:20. We do have the floor at 10. This hearing is scheduled just until 9:30. We could go a little bit over, however, and I do realize that it's hard probably even to form questions with this much material. So, but I wonder if members would like to take this opportunity to ask anything that's on your mind. So happy to take that right now.
Chair Liebling, this is Glenn Grunhagen. I got a couple quick questions.
Yes, Representative Grunhagen. Well, hang on. I just got a, let's see. Okay. Go ahead, Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Chair Liebling. First thing, thank you for including that $10.77 increase in reimbursement under Medicaid for independent pharmacies out here. They're really going to appreciate it. But in Section 11, it says it requires separate cost of dispensing measures for specialty and non-specialty drugs. Can you just clarify that a little bit?
Representative Grunhagen, I'm not 100% sure, but I believe that was a technical issue. I don't know if there's somebody here. Maybe Mr. Burdick remembers. He's on from DHS, or somebody else can help me with that. But I think that was what that was about. Can anyone here answer that question? Mr. Burdick?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Matt Burdick with the Department of Human Services. I don't have the specifics on that item. I do believe that was largely a technical change, but I will get back to the committee with a more concrete answer on that one.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, thank you, Chair Lee. Then a couple quick questions for Mr. Berg, if he'd yield quickly.
Well, go ahead and ask your questions, Representative Grunhagen. We'll find out if Mr. Burdick is the person who needs to answer them.
Well, in the Healthcare Access Fund, the balance drops off dramatically in the later years. And I'm just wondering, what's the primary reason for that?
Madam Chair?
Mr. Berg.
Yeah. Actually, Representative Grunhagen, if you go from the February fund balance, there was a balance of zero in the Healthcare Access Fund in fiscal year 25. And there will be, with this sheet, there's a balance of $94 million, although, as I mentioned, $61 million of that 94 is reserved for a dental initiative. So the sort of the true balance, if you want to look at it, is 33.7 million. So over 4 years, this bill actually puts money into the Healthcare Access Fund. Now, the reason you see that there's a higher number early on and a lower number below, I mentioned there's an item where we are moving money back and forth between biennia so that we hit our 100 million above base net in both biennia and the general fund. So there is some money moved back and forth in the medical assistance program, but that's really just a technical matter back and forth. If you want to look at it from where we started the session, this bill puts $34 million into the Healthcare Access Fund.
Okay, thank you for that explanation. One other quick question, Madam Chair.
Representative Grunhagen, sure.
Yeah, on that University of Minnesota racism curriculum, is that coming back to the legislature for approval, or where is that going? What's the primary goal and purpose of that?
So that is part of the Dignity in Pregnancy and Childbirth Act, which was heard in our committees, came through and got a vetting in our committees, and the Senate accepted that. And it doesn't come back to the legislature. It's a curriculum it's not a school curriculum. It's a curriculum that allows hospitals and other places where people are giving birth to, it's a curriculum for that they can use, that they're not required to use this particular curriculum, but they can use it to educate professionals and others who are having contact with people who are giving birth, so that we can begin to get at the problem of racism that impacts disparities in childbirth outcomes, frankly. And this is a very well-known, we had an extensive hearing on this, so that's what this is about.
Okay, thank you. I got more questions, but I'll save them for the House floor. I'll let other members ask questions. Thank you,
all right.
Manager.
Okay, Representative Ackland and then Dama.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. I just wanted clarification on something, and this has to do with the Medicaid expansion to postpartum women and babies. So in our committee, I know we had the bill had gone through, or the suggestion had gone through for a 12-month expansion. And then I had heard along the way that it had been scaled back to 6 months because of budget constraints. And then I think I'm hearing today that it is 12 months. So I just want a clarification on that.
Absolutely, Representative Ackland. We are very pleased that we were able to expand to 12 months. We did start out with 6 because of the cost. The original bill was for 12. And we got a new fiscal note on it. It was recosted. And so we were able to do that. And of course, the Senate agreed with us. They also came in with 6 months. And I think we're quite willing to go to 12. It was just a matter of cost. But there was no policy reason to keep it at 6.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Representative Damath.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. I know we had talked in committee and we were working on some of the dental issues that I know you care much about, as do I. And I, unless I've missed it in the overview, can you tell me if the dental rate increase is no longer in the proposal? I didn't see it through this.
So there's still a possibility that we could get a deal on dental. There isn't one right now because the Senate's position up to this point has been money without reform. And the House's and administration's position has been that we need reform in the system, that we have been working through the current system and it hasn't been working, and attempts at reform have not been successful. So we're still hoping to get to something on that. And that is why there is money that's being reserved in hopes that we indeed can get to something. But no, there's no rate increase in the bill as it stands right now.
Thank you, Chair Liebling.
Other questions? And on the staff also, I should clarify to Representative Ackland's question that we, when our bill left Ways and Means, we had the 12 months in there. So that was, we went in with that as a House position at the 12 months for the postpartum. So thanks to staff for clarifying that. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just following up on Representative Damath's question about dental, and I know that that has been a very contentious issue between the various parties negotiating this final DE. But you piqued my interest when you said that there may still be a resolution to that item, and you've held money back in reserve to potentially fund it. Just curious your thoughts in terms of how that would be accomplished. Would that move in a separate bill, or how would you view that to be included in this DE or on the floor if agreement has been not to amend the DE?
So, it's not entirely clear, Representative Albright. I think that, it would probably, this is a process that at this point is moving very much by agreement. And so if there's agreement to do something, as you know, in the legislature, if people want to do something, then they agree on it. There's always a way to do it. So I assume that it would be a separate amendment but it would be an agreed upon. It won't move unless it's completely agreed upon between the House and the Senate. So that's about all I can really tell you at this point. But no, the DE is what it is at this point. There are just, logistical issues that with a bill of this size, and I know you know how hard the staff has to work to put something like this together, and so we are considering this to be closed. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow on to that comment then, is there a sense in terms of the provision itself? Is it a function of funding, or are there triggers involved with when that funding would be invoked? Could you elaborate in terms of what the sticking points are around that issue? Because I know that a number of the members, both on your committee as well as Representative Schultz's committee, have certainly a very heightened interest in that, and just certainly curious in terms of where that stands.
Well, what I can tell you, Representative Albright, is that the money that was on the spreadsheet that was agreed to included, it was that the Senate agreed to the House proposal on the money, and the money that was included and that is now being parked in the Healthcare Access Fund included a rate increase, not a rebasing, but a rate increase and simplification under which no providers lost money. And there would be an average increase of 103% across the board. So significant increase. And then in 2 years, if there was not significant benchmarks reached, that the state would move to a new system where we would be under one contracted dental administrator to administer the whole program and take it out of the, how it works right now, where it runs through both our fee-for-service program, and then we have 8 different managed care organizations that run our medical assistance program, and every one of them does it differently. And they hire an administrator to run the dental program for the most part. And so we have this very fragmented program where we, the legislators, don't have any real oversight over it because we don't even know how much providers get paid. I mean, you've heard me talk about this many, many times, how our system of managed care, how we run our public programs, is very difficult for us to manage. Members don't know where the money's going. We don't have any control over it. So DHS has tried to work with these managed care organizations for several years to improve access to dental. And we've had many, many conversations in our committees about this and what the problems are and why aren't there more providers and how can we get more access? And none of that has worked. And so besides raising rates, our original proposal coming out of the House was to go to a different system, that we believed that this system has failed our Minnesotans on our public programs. It is not providing the level of dental access that we need. And I think everybody agrees with that. And the real question is, how do we do better? Well, in our bill, we propose to do better by going to a new system and raising rates. Representative Ryer worked extensively on this as well. We do have in the bill now a dental homes initiative where, and that's all agreed upon, that there will be work done to develop a new model. So that is in process. It's going to happen rather quickly. We'll have the results from that. And so our hope is what we wanted to do was take that new model and use it with a single administrator and figure out then a new payment method to reward value for our people on our public programs and to improve our program instead of the very fragmented payment system and administration system that we have now. So where we are right now, the money that was agreed to by the Senate includes both the raising of the rates, as I mentioned, and streamlining of the rate, and it also includes a so-called trigger, a contingent move to a single administrator in 2 years if they don't meet certain benchmarks. So the Senate has backed off on that, has, you know, gone back and forth, and we're going to either conclude that or we're not. I don't know, but my contention and our contention is that we do need higher rates, but we also need reform. And I think that Republicans usually would say that throwing money at a problem does not solve it. So we need both higher rates, but we also need reform. We can't have one without the other. Are there other questions? All right, well, I'm not seeing any. Chair Schultz, did you wanna say a few words here before we conclude? And I do wanna give a few thank yous, and but please, I want to give you a moment to wrap up if you would like.
Well, I just want to just thank all of the committee members throughout session, helping us put together this bill by carrying and championing and introducing legislation. And I apologize for not being able to include everything. We do still have limited budgets, even though we had significant financial or federal resources. I also want to thank our staff who worked long hours and have not gotten much sleep. So hopefully they'll be able to catch up on their sleep after we get the bill off the floor. I want to thank our nonpartisan staff and fiscal staff working on so many different versions and offers as we negotiated and compromised the final bill. And also agency staff and the commissioners, but especially Chair Liebling for leading us through this difficult process of putting the bill together and making sure we could get as many bills as we could and not giving up on efforts even when negotiations stalled. So thank you, Chair Liebling, and thank you everybody for working on the bill. And we're eager to present this publicly on the floor.
Thank you, Chair Schultz. So I would just conclude by saying, first of all, I think that what we have is a bill that we can all be extremely proud of. And I really want to do a big shout out to all of my colleagues who worked with me so closely on this, both my legislative colleagues. And so Chair Schultz, Chair Pinto, Chair Gomez, Chair Fisher, and all the members who contributed to this bill in all ways, large and small, and there were many, many. And all of you, including members of the minority whose good questions have made the bill better. And I'm very pleased that we were able to agree on so many things with the Senate. And we have here a bill that is, I do not think we'll see in another generation, a bill that is as good as this one, frankly. This is certainly the best HHS bill I have seen in my career here. And notwithstanding that there are some disappointments in it, I don't want to gloss over that. There are. This bill doesn't do everything. There will still be work to do. And there are things that the Senate just would not agree with us on that had to be left on the floor. And that is the way omnibus bills always work. I do want to, as Chair Schultz mentioned, I do especially want to thank our staff. This has been an incredibly heavy lift for everyone, and our House research staff who have to draft and sort through and approve every single word. And members know that the final product is just the tip of the iceberg here for all the work they have to do. Drafting amendments, bills that never made it in, and just incredible work that they do for us. Elizabeth Clarkvist, Sarah Sunderman, Randy Chun, Danielle Punelli, and Annie Mock. And then, of course, Doug Berg, who I already mentioned. He is just an amazing resource for us. Of course, there are many others. We call them partisan researchers. That just means they work for one caucus or the other, but Joe Durheim, Molly Peterson on the DFL side, Jeremiah Wingstedt, and Jody Withers on the Republican side. My legislative assistant, who is just so wonderful, Krista Niedernhofer, And then, of course, our amazing team of committee administrators who all worked so hard and worked as a team on this and continue. Their jobs are not over. And, you know, here we are almost the end of June and no one should be working now in the legislature. They're supposed to be on break. And here they are with us. Yingya, Polly, Chris, Patrick. And, you know, we'll mention them again on the floor, but, you know, they're just amazing. We're so blessed to have everybody working here with us. And the public is blessed. Most importantly, the public is really blessed to have these folks working for them and working so hard. So with that, thank you. And thank you again to the commissioners and your incredible staffs that I mentioned before. It is just... everything that I said about the House staff, it of course, applies across the board. You are wonderful public servants, and we, on behalf of Minnesotans, we thank you so very much. So with that, members, I'm going to let you go. Thank you so much for attending today, and look forward to seeing you again soon. Take care. We are adjourned.